Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and my guest today is David Leibovitz, global strategist on the multi-asset solutions team at JP Morgan Asset Management. We previously had David on the podcast to discuss the history and creation of the Guide to Alternatives, a publication he was instrumental in creating and one that I am proud to now lead. On today's episode, we will be discussing a different publication that David helps lead, JP Morgan's Long-Term Capital Market Assumptions, or the LTCMAs for short. The LTCMAs are celebrating their 30th annual publication this year, providing return, volatility, and correlation estimates for over 200 asset classes in 17 currencies. The LTCMAs are widely respected across the industry and drive roughly $1 trillion in long-term investment portfolios across the business. It's a great discussion, so let's jump right into it. David, welcome back to Alternative Realities. For listeners that didn't get a chance to hear our last conversation, can you give listeners a little bit of background on yourself and your career here at JP Morgan?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it's good to be back. Thank you for having me. So I've been at JP Morgan for 15 years. I had the pleasure of graduating during the global financial crisis, was just happy to get a job, to be completely honest, and spent 13 of those 15 years actually working on your current team, the Market Insights team, for Dr. David Kelly. So when I joined, there were five of us. We made this book called The Guide to the Markets. Over time, that obviously grew into the powerhouse that it is today, and it includes Guide to Alternatives and all of the other resources that your team puts together. A couple of years ago, I did make the transition over to our multi-asset solutions business, where I now work on the fundamental research team, helping generate not only our long-term capital market assumptions, which I know we're going to discuss here today, but also the more tactical views that are then reflected in all of the multi-asset portfolios that we manage. So, you know, trading one research hat for another is the way that I think of it. But again, just glad to be back on the podcast.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you. So last time you were on the podcast, we talked about your role in the Guide to Alternatives and putting that together. And it obviously has come a very long way, the Guide to the Markets and the Guide to Alternatives now. Let's talk about another publication that you're very involved in, the Long-Term Capital Markets Assumptions process. Yep. We'll shorten it to LTCMAs because that's a bit of a mouthful, but tremendously important publication. Can you tell us a little bit about what is that publication and what's the importance of it?
Absolutely. So the long-term capital market assumptions represent the view coming from asset management on what the economy and the capital markets are going to do over the course of the next 10 to 15 years. The first thing I'll say is that we chose 10 to 15 years because we think that generally speaking, that is reflective of a full business cycle. Mm-hmm. And so we're not trying to get too cute with, you know, where are we in the business cycle today and how is that shaping our views? We're basically saying that we're gonna finish at the point where we're currently starting, right? A full cycle. We forecast real GDP. We forecast inflation. We forecast a variety of different assets across both the public and private market spectrum, which I know we're going to talk about here today. And in terms of the process itself, so more than 100 people are part of this. We spend something like 9,000 hours over the course of 6 months to produce these assumptions, and then they get used by people internally, people externally, when they think about building diversified portfolios, when they think about creating wealth plans for high net worth individuals, right? The reach of this document is really quite broad. And, you know, excitingly, we celebrated the 30th anniversary of the LTCMAs this year. So we've been doing this for 30 years. And if you look at the forecasts that we have generated relative to a random sample, we are twice as accurate. And so not only have we done this for a long time, but we're also pretty good at it when all is said and done. And so looking forward to unpacking this in a little bit more detail during our time together today.
Wonderful. Yeah, and that speaks to the reliance that a lot of people put in this, exactly, in this document and the amount of capital that it influences.
Exactly.
So there's a lot happening around the world right now, a lot of things you could focus on. What are some of the big themes that you decided to focus on within the LTCMAs this year?
So it's funny, right? We go through that whole process, the 6 months, 100 plus people, however many thousand hours, so on and so forth. And then we get to the end and it's like, all right, well, how do we distill this down so that we can have conversations with clients that are going to be meaningful, impactful, and intelligible? And so this time around, we really came away from the process with this idea that the next 10 to 15 years are going to be characterized by shifting landscapes, but also some silver linings. And so what do I really mean by that? Well, when we look at what's happening in the world today, we're seeing economic nationalism continue to rise. So the idea that governments are focused more on their own backyard than they are on their neighbors. We continue to see this kind of fiscal activism and much greater appetite for fiscal spending than certainly was the case in places like Europe following the financial crisis. And then we also view kind of technology investment and adoption, and obviously a lot of that is tied to AI, as being a central theme as well. And so when we think about the interaction of these three themes, you know, economic nationalism reflects things like tighter borders, different trade lines, so on and so forth, right? Things that are very much a headwind when it comes to the overall pace of economic growth. Fiscal activism and more investment spending is kind of a double-edged sword, right? Because investment spending can be good, but too much money chasing too few goods can also lead to inflation and higher volatility of inflation. And so we think that that's somewhere in the middle. But the antidote to all of this, to less labor supply, to you know, inflation that is getting pushed up from the bottom as opposed to down from the top, really lies in this theme of technology adoption, investment, and deployment, and the idea that as we focus more on things like artificial intelligence, that will have a meaningful boost, that will provide a meaningful boost to productivity growth over time, helping to offset some of that inflationary pressure and helping to offset some of the other forces that are weighing on our growth forecasts over the next 10 to 15 years.
Okay. And speaking of forecasts, I know when the book comes out, everybody flips to the returns numbers first, maybe comes back to the commentary. So let's talk about, because that's one of the really interesting things you do. You forecast the returns both on the public side and the alternative side. Focusing on the public stock and bond returns first, what's your outlook for returns in these areas?
So the first thing that I'll say is that this was a year where I walked away from the process saying to people, look, the environment we're headed in to, the economy and the capital markets are two completely different things. So as an example, we actually downgraded our estimate for U.S. real GDP growth by 20 basis points this year from 2% to 1.8% on an expectation of basically no growth in the labor force over the forecast horizon. Now, you might at face value say, David, you downgraded, you know, the U.S. growth figure by 20 basis points. That had to have some knock-on effect to the U.S. equity figure. But the reality is that what we're seeing is an environment where corporate profitability is improving, margins are becoming more resilient, and we think that there's definitely an AI productivity dynamic tied to all of that. And so, you know, importantly, despite a downgrade to real growth for the U.S. over the next 10 to 15 years, we actually kept that U.S. large cap return assumption stable at 6.7%. If you actually look at how our earnings forecasts have evolved over the past couple of years, the U.S. large cap earnings growth forecast is up 110 basis points over the past 2 years. We simply view these companies as being more profitable going forward than has been the case in the past. Another key theme coming through on the public equity side, and then I'll move on and talk a little bit about fixed income, is that valuations are going to be a drag across the board. It's really a question of how much. And again, using the U.S. as an example, we forecast a 2 percentage point annual drag from valuation over the forecast horizon. That implicitly says that at some point here, we will have a 20%+ correction over the next 10 to 15 years. And so these numbers are not Pollyannish, right? We don't have our rose-colored glasses on. It's really the fundamentals that are setting us free from some of these macroeconomic headwinds that have been created.
And that's coming from where valuations are today at very elevated levels.
Exactly.
Sort of a mean reversion.
Exactly. And not even really a mean reversion, but more so coming off of the boil. Because if we said that public equity return assumptions are going to revert to their long-term average, we would have a much lower return estimate in the current environment. What we're saying is, given the way that the market has changed, it's become more profitable, it's become growthier, we do think that valuations need to come in, but perhaps by not as much as has been the case or as would be the case if things were to revert to the mean.
Okay.
On the fixed income side, it's interesting because what's really driving our views there is the idea of higher starting points and steeper curves. And so you look at where yields are today relative to where yields were in the immediate aftermath of COVID or in the aftermath of 2008, right? And your starting point is just more attractive. At the same time, we do view these forces of economic nationalism and fiscal activism as creating more risk in the system. And we think that's going to be represented by steeper yield curves. And so higher yields today, steeper curves over time, that's really what powers the fixed income returns and has allowed us, I should say, to increase our 10-year Treasury return assumption to 4.6%, which is the most robust it has been since the financial crisis. So there's income back in fixed income. There's even some return there, too.
Yeah, brilliant. So switching gears now to the alternative side, what's your outlook for alternative asset classes?
So while the public market side of things saw return outlooks kind of flat to slightly higher in many cases, the alternative return assumptions are looking pretty good across the board. We always differentiate within alternatives between real assets and financial assets. If we think about the real asset side of the equation, one of the numbers that continues to jump out at us is the U.S. core real estate number. We actually nudged that up 20 basis points to 8.2% this year, really to reflect those more attractive starting valuations, not all that different from last year. I mean, we haven't seen a meaningful re-rating in U.S. real estate valuations, and that allows us to generate that 8% return expectation over the next 10 to 15 years. Thinking about some of the non-US markets, the story is a little bit more mixed. We did increase the APAC number. The Europe number is down a little bit. The REIT numbers have caught a lot of attention. What's driving those more robust forecasts is really the underlying sector composition of those markets. And so not only do you get a net benefit from things like leverage, but you also get more exposure to things like data centers, and so on and so forth. Infrastructure nudges higher as well on expectations that we're going to need more power, a more robust grid in order to make all of this AI actually come to fruition. Right. And then we did nudge transport higher as well to just reflect those shifting global supply chains and trade routes. On the financial alternative side of the equation, so private equity, private credit, hedge funds, so on and so forth, we did nudge the private equity numbers higher again this year. Not only does that reflect stability in the public market return expectation, which goes into that calculation, but also a greater benefit from the use of leverage. Hedge funds saw returns move higher as well. We think this is going to be a better environment for active managers. We think less stable correlation, wider dispersion of returns, rates that don't go back to zero. Again, all of that very supportive for hedge funds. And then finally, direct lending. And I know we're going to unpack this in more detail in just a little bit. We did downgrade this time around for a number of different reasons that we can discuss further.
Yeah, it'd be great to touch on that because it is an outlier in terms of the alternative assets. Fairly bullish case for most alternative assets, but then looking at private credit, and I wonder how much of this is the recent defaults we've heard in the market, a lot of capital coming into the market. What's driving the downgrade for the outlook for private credit?
So I would say that it's not as much about recent credit events specifically, but it's more about what those events imply about what potentially could be coming over the next 10 to 15 years. And so what I will say about the private credit, and we're talking direct lending here, we've been asked to do things like special sits and distress. That's, you know, something in the hopper that we're discussing. But when you look at the direct lending assumption, it did fall by 50 basis points from 8.2% to 7.7%, really on the back of two things. One being a higher default loss assumption, right? So when we look at the growth in the number of managers, the number of assets, you know, there are bound to be some bad apples amongst the bunch. And so from our vantage point, increasing that default loss assumption from 2% to 2.5% was a very reasonable thing to do. The other thing that's going on with this return assumption is that, and this is true of all markets, but we view the line between public and private as becoming increasingly blurry. And that's especially the case within credit. And so, you know, a little bit tighter spread relative to things like loans, more flexibility if you think about private equity in terms of where they want to get their financing, right? It's just, it's creating a more competitive market. And so the combination of that more competitive market coupled with a default loss assumption, which in my view needs to be higher compared to where it's been, right? Both of those came together to drag the number lower. But I would say still very much looking at a premium relative to things like high yield. And so we're not saying that all the juice has been squeezed out of the orange. We're just saying that this is an asset class that's come a long way in a relatively short period of time. And we think it's important to monitor both the risks as well as the opportunities.
Yeah, that's, it sounds very similar to what we talk about and look at in the Guide to Alternatives,
exactly.
Which is, of course, maybe a shorter-term outlook, but we see defaults increasing. We see a lot of restructurings happening in the market,
right,
which is indicative of defaults potentially coming down the line. And I always try to make the point that it's not just the direct lending space. There's a broader private credit market
yeah.
that investors should take a look at. Distressed lending,
exactly.
special situations, a growing secondaries market. So there are ways to de-risk even
right.
within private credit.
Exactly.
So turning to commodities, and I know that's one of the other areas you look at within the long-term capital market assumptions. Gold mm-hmm. Has been on a tear over the last year, couple of years. What's your outlook for gold going forward?
So the first thing I'll highlight is that we did switch from showing the commodity return assumptions on a net basis to showing them on a gross basis, right? We basically view it as being costless to transact in things like gold futures and a broad basket of commodity ETF. And so we wanted to make that shift, and that's part of what has pushed the numbers higher. Beyond that, I'd really say that there are three things providing support to that gold number, and it does get a lot of attention given the returns that gold has generated so far year to date. The first is that we continue to believe that central banks will diversify their reserves away from fiat currency. So this isn't about de-dollarization specifically. It's just about holding more gold within their reserves, and that's a trend that we've seen playing out over the better part of the past couple of years. The second thing has to do with retail demand. So when we look at markets like India, we look at markets like China, right? Gold and gold jewelry is obviously something that is highly sought after. We don't view that demand as going away anytime soon and very much view that as being a feature and not a bug of the forecast horizon. And then the third thing has to do with the way people think about building portfolios. And, you know, I feel like I can't open up my headlines each day without seeing something about debasement and the end of, U.S. exceptionalism and so on and so forth. And I don't really buy into all of that. I think U.S. economic exceptionalism may start to fade. U.S. corporate exceptionalism is still very much in play. But I think that given what we were discussing earlier around higher volatility of inflation, higher volatility in capital markets, less stable stock bond correlations, right? People remember 2020 when stocks and bonds sold off together, and they're going to look to hold assets in their portfolios that can provide a bit of protection in environments like that. And so we think gold fits the bill quite nicely because, again, it's not as burdensome as going out and doing all the paperwork around an alternative, a private strategy, but you can still get some of the benefits that those strategies have to offer. And so in general, when we think about alternatives, whether it be real assets, financial assets, commodities. I mean, the transition from optional to essential, it very much continues.
Yeah, that need for diversification
exactly.
is just a huge driver.
Exactly.
So I'd like to end our conversation on this topic of the illiquidity premium between public and private assets. So private assets generally have an illiquidity premium, an alpha over public assets in your outlook. Where is this coming from? Do you see the illiquidity premium persisting over that time, particularly with the amount of capital that's coming into private markets?
So what I would say about the illiquidity premium, first of all, when we model the alternatives and the private markets, we're always thinking about the median manager, right? So we're not modeling top quartile. We're not modeling bottom quartile. We're saying kind of what's the middle of the road experience that you're going to get from this asset class. From there, we do think about a premium relative to public markets. But to me, like the illiquidity premium is kind of a catch-all for all the things that you can do in private markets that you can't do in public markets. Mm. So take private equity as an example, right? You've got a lockup, you've got a long-term holding period, you can actually impact the operations of the underlying assets, right? That's completely different from the approach that you can take and the role that you can play in the public markets. And so, you know, is it an illiquidity premium? Sure, we can call it that because people can't move their money in and out the way that they can on the public side. But I really think that there's a lot more to it. It's the operational side of things. It's the sector breakdown. It's the ability to use leverage, right? All of this comes together and gives you that private market premium more so than an illiquidity premium. Now, you mentioned a very good point, which is we're in this environment where everybody's talking about alternatives, right? I can't walk into a room or a client meeting without the topic coming up in the first 10 minutes. People are now saying, look at the shifts that are going on in regulation. What if we see more private market investments in, you know, things like retirement accounts, so on and so forth? To me, this is akin to building more on-ramps to a highway. Like, you're just going to end up with more cars and more traffic. And I don't necessarily think that means that the return that these assets can generate comes down meaningfully over time. I think it more so has to do with the dispersion of returns going forward. There will still be managers out there who can do this very well, but if there's a lot of capital searching for a home, you're probably going to end up with managers who maybe aren't so adept at managing in that space, and that just creates a wider spread between the winners and the losers. Does it weigh marginally on the overall return over time? Sure, I wouldn't push back too hard on that, but I think it's going to come through more on the dispersion front than it is in a meaningful downgrade to the return that these assets can generate over time.
Okay, that's very helpful. Yeah, when we present this, we have a slide in the Guide to Alternatives on that dispersion between asset classes, and I use that in every client presentation because it's a really important one to mention to clients. The premium still exists between public and private assets, but that dispersion is very large today and potentially will increase over time.
Exactly. And that's a great chart, too. I remember when we put that into the original version, so I'm glad to hear it's still in there
and still being loosed. Well, David, it's been a pleasure having you again on Alternative Realities. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was David Leibovitz, Global Strategist in the Multi-Asset Solutions Group at JP Morgan Asset Management. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our recently released third quarter 2025 Guide to Alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.